Welcome to American Indian Living, a program developed by the Native Education and Health Initiative to improve and enhance the health of people throughout the Native communities. American Indian Living is hosted by Dr. David DeRose, a board-certified specialist in both internal medicine and preventive medicine. Dr. DeRose has a wide range of experience with Native health issues, and he's ready today to help you learn more about your health. Here's Dr. DeRose.
Welcome to American Indian Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. Today we're speaking about a problem that continues to grab headlines. They're not just headlines throughout Indian country, but they're headlines throughout actually every population group that inhabits North America and beyond. We're talking about issues that relate to suicide, perhaps one of the most devastating consequences that can happen in any family, in any community. And Native Americans are not shielded from the consequences of what many are labeling a modern-day epidemic. We want to look at practical things that we can do to make a difference when it comes to the younger generations in our cultures, in our tribes, in our communities. And to help us do that is someone who has devoted considerable energies professionally to this. His name is Robert Bossart. Dr. Bossart is the assistant professor at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester, among other appointments. Robert, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Among those other appointments is one that would get people's attention in research circles. You're actually the chief for epidemiology and health services research at the Center of Excellence at Canandaigua. Am I pronouncing that right, even though I get a little tongue-tied with all that verbiage there?
You're very close, yes. It's the Center of Excellence for Canandaigua. We are a Department of Veterans Affairs research facility, and our primary mission is to develop and implement, and assess suicide prevention strategies for veterans.
Okay, so someone who is dealing with health research, someone who is interested in suicide prevention in an academic setting, they would know about this Center of Excellence for Canandaigua, correct?
More than likely, we're a relatively new center. We were established in 2007. How they would probably know of us is we are the home for the National Suicide Prevention Veterans Hotline, which was also established in the latter part of 2007, early 2008. And that is now, if anyone calls the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, they are given an option to press 1 if they are a veteran, and it will route their call to our facility.
Okay. Now, I think just the very fact of the existence of your center seems to underscore something that many people have been sensing, regardless of what their cultural background is, and that is that we're facing some really serious issues when it comes to suicide in North America. Is that just a lay perception, or does the research bear out that there is a growing problem?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's a lay perception at all. I think it's an accurate perception, and one that's that is far too often, I think, at least under-recognized. I think people within public health will be able to tell you that they've heard the statistics several times. Suicide is the 11th leading cause of death for all Americans and the third leading cause of death for Americans under the age of 45. And it's been getting more attention in the press recently, as I'm sure you're aware, with the downturn in the economic situation. And whether that's directly related or not, the economy and the focus on the changing environment has certainly brought some of the suicide prevention activities and suicide in general, I think, to the forefront.
So our country really has been focusing on a variety of things to do in the United States, Canada as well, I'm sure, is taking steps. People listen to the show throughout North America and beyond. Give us a little feel for what this suicide prevention hotline is really doing as far as impact, and just some information about it, because I know as we're launching the program, this is something very practical that someone could utilize even today if they're dealing with some of these issues or know of someone who they may be concerned about.
Absolutely, and what I would not be doing my job if I didn't say that the phone number is 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K. And that is a manned suicide prevention hotline. It's manned 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's free and confidential. It's actually a network of over 130 crisis centers nationwide that will handle telephone calls as they come in. What makes our our operation unique is that if you happen to be a veteran of U.S. military service, your call, regardless of where your call originates from, is routed to our center here in Canandaigua. And it, our clinicians and staff here at the center are the ones that will handle calls for veterans and be able to talk to them about what their crisis might be and channel them to appropriate care. And the same would be true whether you're a veteran or not. The only difference is who handles your call.
Okay, so that's 1-800-273-TALK, if I got that correct?
Absolutely correct, 1-800-273-TALK.
So let's just step back a little bit further. You've got special research interest. I mean, you're known throughout the research community for the work you've been doing, Dr. Bossart. Why is there a special line for veterans? I mean, this may be obvious to some people, but many Native Americans have served in the U.S. military, and I think it's worth highlighting this point. Is there a special need? Do you need people who have special training? Help us understand that a little better.
Well, I think both. The special line for veterans is reflective of the Department of Veterans Affairs' commitment to serving veterans and providing a service to veterans in what has become a high priority for the Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs, and that's to address risk for suicide among the veteran population. It's just another extension of clinical service and health benefits to veterans, a service that can help them bring them into care, because many veterans are eligible for care within the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Veterans Health Administration. This is a way of providing another service to them and bringing them into care if care is needed.
Great. So whether a person's a veteran or not, if they're dealing with thoughts of suicide, if they're maybe just feeling very depressed, if the outlook looks very bleak, they can just pick up the phone and call 1-800-273-TALK? Is that all they need to do, I mean, at least initially?
That is all they need to do. And the reason the hotline is so important is we so often hear that mental illness or thoughts of suicide, or if you're struggling with depression, we hear a lot about stigma in the community and the fact that people are reluctant to seek help because they're afraid of being labeled as having a mental illness or being somebody who's suicidal. And this gives them a way of just, in the confidentiality and anonymity of their home, picking up a phone, being able to call somebody and talk to somebody about it, and to be able to reach out for care. And really, that's the critical part about the suicide prevention hotline, is it provides that immediate access to trained staff who can help them identify the best source of treatment and be able to provide them with some immediate relief.
I mean, that's excellent. I mean, if you've heard nothing else on today's show, I mean, this is a life-saving number, 1-800-273-TALK. But we've got a lot more to talk about on today's show. Dr. Bossart has done extensive research into suicide prevention. And, Robert, we really want to talk about this subject because I think every parent, every grandparent, every elder, whoever a person may be, whether they're listening today in Indian country or outside of it, they're concerned about this issue. If they're concerned about the younger generations in particular, where this seems to be hitting so hard, as you mentioned, the third leading cause of death in those under 45. You've looked at the whole issue of things that may increase the risk of suicide, presumably even later in life. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. While a lot of my work has been done with adolescents, my research includes persons of all ages. Yes.
Okay. So help us. We're influential people in our communities. Every single person has a role to play. And if we're looking at adolescents, because you've done a fair amount of research in that population, are there things we can do for the teenagers in our communities that can make it less likely for them down the road to consider suicide or even make an attempt on their life?
Well, the easy answer is yes, of course. And there are any number of things you can do. Some of them are to encourage help-seeking behaviors, and what we've talked about a little bit already and one of the functions that the hotline provides. And the other is to be able to be aware of risk factors, things that would enhance the opportunities for suicide or to create an environment where a person who might be in distress or is in need of help is not able to reach out or not able to access services. And so creating an environment where people feel comfortable to talk about depression or some crises they might have is critically important, as well as remaining aware of things that would enhance risk. In particular, one of the things that we've been looking at extensively recently is substance abuse among the early adolescents.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So when you talk in research circles, early adolescence, I mean, for someone who's just tuning in, I mean, what age is that? When does someone become an early adolescent?
Well, we've been defining, for the purpose of our work, we're looking at early adolescence as before 13 years of age. So what we're okay. particularly concerned about at this point is youth who would begin substance use, particularly alcohol use, before they reach the age of 13 years.
Okay. And is that, as you look at it, is there some special indicator if a child is using alcohol before 13 that puts them at higher risk down the road of suicidal behavior?
Well, there's an extensive body of research that's looked at early alcohol use and its consequences into later adolescence and early adulthood. And the literature has shown pretty consistently that early alcohol use, and again, we're talking about early adolescence before 13 years of age, has been associated with a number of bad outcomes, and they include things like increased involvement in the criminal system, interpersonal violence, substance abuse disorders, high-risk sexual activities. And so the question was for us and my colleague and I, my colleague is Monica Swan, who's a psychiatric epidemiologist at Georgia State University. We wanted to know whether this is also something that would enhance risk for self-directed violence and suicidal behaviors. Mm-hmm. And that's really where we began. And to give you a little bit of background on it, the prevalence of, and the reason this is important, is the prevalence of early alcohol use is really quite high. When you first mention to people that you're interested in the effects of alcohol use before the age of 13 years, most people, I think, initially would react to that as if it's not something that's very prevalent. But the data collected really don't support that. There is the nation's largest surveillance system for risk behaviors among adolescents is called the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System, and it's a mm-hmm. nationally representative survey of high school students that's conducted by the CDC every 2 years. And when you look at those data, then the prevalence has gone down a little bit, but the most recent year that estimates are available for is 2007, and almost 24% of all adolescents reported using alcohol for the first time before the age of 13. So it's something that we know is prevalent. It's something that is, in fact, something that should be preventable and yet is not at this point, at least for over a quarter of youth who respond to the survey.
So let me see if I understand this correctly. When we speak about alcohol use, at least as far as the data that we have access to, we're really looking at any youth who reports that they've used alcohol at all. I mean, it doesn't mean they're necessarily polishing off a six-pack a week or anything. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. It's a rather broad definition of alcohol use, and it's the question that's typically asked is, you know, how old were you when you had your first drinks of alcohol that were not in the presence of your parents? So they try to, even though I would disagree, they try to provide a question that would sort of eliminate condone drinking and try to focus more on what people would typically think of as problem drinking.
Okay.
But yes,
okay.
It could be any alcohol use at all.
So basically, we're looking then, at least the research and the questions that are asked are trying to look at kids who are getting into problems early on. They're drinking without their parents, their elders being aware of it, and this is supposed to be an indicator that it's not just, you know, the dad gave the kid a beer to, you know, teach him or her to be a man or woman early on. Although we probably want to debate the wisdom of introducing adulthood in that way.
Exactly. In fact, I would say we don't want to introduce adulthood that way. But your point is well taken, that they're trying to get at drinking that was drinking for alcohol use, not necessarily something that happened in a social function or something that would otherwise be thought of as being not as dangerous as other forms of drinking behavior, although I think that you're exactly right that any alcohol use at this point, particularly alcohol use that appears to be condoned by adults or by elders, would be alcohol use that might be, in fact, more dangerous than other alcohol use.
So let's come back then. We've got this background. It's a huge problem. 24% of young North Americans engaging in this behavior. We've got to look at some of the connections and what we can do about it. Dr. Robert Bossart is with us throughout the entirety of today's show on American Indian Living. A lot of very important insights into suicide prevention. Cutting-edge information you don't want to miss. Don't go away. I'm Dr. DeRose. We'll be back with more.
recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
Today's American Indian Living Radio program is sponsored in part by the Native Education and Health Initiative, also known as NAHI, a nonprofit organization established by Native Americans for Native Americans. In addition to sponsoring American Indian Living, NAHI produces a health publication and has initiated a series of programs to combat diabetes. Further information about NAHI is available at nahicharity.org. The Lifestyle Center of America is another American Indian Living sponsor. Located in South Central Oklahoma, the Lifestyle Center provides a variety of health services in Indian country, including residential diabetes treatment programs and their Wellspring DVD series, a prepackaged diabetes program suitable for home, workplace, or community center used by people of all races. Further information about the center is available at lifestylecenter.org or by phone at 1-800-596-5480.
Some important social statements by United States citizens today on policy.
To be a good American, you've got to like people, share things, and not scream at people. And you should also help them, and then you can share at them.
A statement on historical tradition and our form of government.
I love America because it got government full of people, and full of people. For the people.
A statement on down-to-earth American idealism.
I like living in America because it means freedom. It means that you can do most stuff you want as long as it doesn't, like, hurt anybody and you have to work hard to keep it.
America, a statement in summary.
I love America because everybody's equal. And when you play with other kids and they dunk you, you can dunk them back.
You're listening to a pre-recorded broadcast of American Indian Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE, 1-800-775-4673. Here again is your host.
Welcome back to American Indian Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. We're speaking with Dr. Robert Bossart. Dr. Bossart is an expert in the area of suicide prevention and a variety of other health research areas. He is currently the assistant professor with the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester in New York. He is also the chief for epidemiology and health service research at the Center of Excellence for Canandaigua. And Dr. Bossart, we were speaking before the break about this, the large numbers of young people across North America and the United States, the data that you're particularly looking at, who are using alcohol before the age of 13. Give us that statistic once more.
Sure. In 2007, the national estimate was 23.8% of all adolescents under the age of 13 years began drinking alcohol.
You know, I guess one of the things when people hear a statistic like that, they say, well, wow, if 24% are using alcohol, I mean, what about some of these other, drugs and mind-altering substances? Are these also big problems in that young an age group? Do we have data on that question?
Yeah, we do, actually. And there are a couple of really good data sources that people could look at if they're interested in investigating this a little further or learning some more. And one is the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance Survey that the Centers for Disease Control publishes. And the other is a National Survey for Drug Use and Health, which is provided by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And the Youth Risk Behavior Survey includes smoking and marijuana, particularly the measures that allow you to look at how old they were when they started that. And the National Survey of Drug Use and Health includes a number of components, including alcohol, smoking, tobacco, marijuana, inhalant use, so some sort of spray can or other inhalant that would be used for the purpose of altering themselves, and then prescription drug abuse that also allows you to look at that. And so when you compare the prevalence of these different ingredients, and for a moment I'll speak just about people between the ages of roughly 13 and 15, because there's a little bit of a question about how accurate some of these adolescents might be in recalling the age they first used it as they get a little older. So So if we restrict our conversation to just those who are between the ages of 13 and 15, in 2007, about 30% of youth reported using alcohol for the first time, according to the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance Survey. And about 15%, 14.4%, reported smoking cigarettes, and about 9% using marijuana the first time. If you look at the similar data from the National Survey of Drug Use and Health, about 22% reported drinking alcohol for the first time, about 17% smoking, 5% marijuana, about 15% reported using some sort of inhalant, and about 7% reported using prescription drugs. Now, when I say using prescription drugs, it should be important to point out as well that they're specifically after prescription drugs that were either not prescribed for them or were taken simply for the way it made them feel and not for the way that they were prescribed. The prescription drug use as well as becoming or misuse is becoming a growing problem in this country.
So 7%, is that the figure on the prescription drug abuse and the 13 to 15-year-olds?
In 2006, yes.
2006. So basically we're looking, I mean, if you kind of pool all that data, is it 40% of 13 to 15-year-olds that are using some kind of substance, or is that not a figure that's easy to come by?
Well, it's you would have to collapse across categories. I mean, I would say you're probably in the range there because these kids are going to report multiple substance use.
Exactly. So basically, we've got a huge problem throughout North America, whether we're looking at Indian country, whether we're looking at any other demographic in North America. This is a huge issue, and it's especially of interest to you and other researchers who are looking at suicide prevention, because there seem to be some very significant associations between substance use and suicide. Am I getting that correct?
You're getting that correct. And I think the reason that I'm so particularly interested and the reason that it's so very important is that it's completely preventable. And so these are substances and activities that can be addressed within the home and within the community, and efforts can be taken and have been taken to reduce access and to increase awareness and education about what the long-term consequences could be of actually using these substances. And that's why we continue to do this line of research and why it's so interesting to me. And not just research, I mean, I hate to sort of sterilize it that way, because it's more than that. It's prevention, and it's a career effort. And to do this sort of work, to increase awareness, and one of the reasons that I'm so very happy to be here today, is to continue to spread the message that these are completely modifiable behaviors, and for theoretically at least, these are things that could be controlled and kept out of the hands of kids. And by doing so, you not only reduce the risk for suicide, which is, of course, very important to us, but increase the chances that you're going to have healthy late adolescence and young adulthood by driving down the possibilities of, you know, increased criminal activity, high-risk sexual behaviors, later substance dependency. And a lot of this can simply be prevented by paying attention to access and use early on.
You know, I guess one of the big questions that people always ask when they hear epidemiologic data, and for those who, you know, listen to the show, they've heard us explain some of these scientific concepts, but basically we're just studying what happens to people groups, and that's what, you know, epidemiology is. You and I know that. But we draw these associations, these relationships. Many people, they say, well, you know, kind of the chicken or the egg question. I mean, is the drug use, is it a sign that there are problems in the home, problems in the community? Is the drug use itself the thing that is causing the suicide? Have you tried to tease out how substance use and suicide are related, or is that such a difficult question that we're still, even in the research community, searching for answers?
Well, I can tell you that we're trying to tease it out. And as myself and Monica Swan, who I mentioned earlier, are actively working on a project that's looking at exactly that. Monica has a grant funded by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, where we're trying to understand exactly the role between early alcohol use and later risk for suicide. Part of the problems with that, of course, are that it's difficult to track people over time and temporally to understand when they begin drinking and when the suicidal behaviors emerge. Now, the question about early exposure to alcohol and long-term consequences and cognitive deficits and behavioral and social problems, those have for a long time been established in the existing literature, either children who are exposed prenatally by maternal alcohol use or who are exposed to alcohol very early in their developing childhood years during the periods of key cognitive development, the consequences of that alcohol exposure have been pretty firmly established. The relationships between early alcohol use and risk for suicide, those are becoming clearer and more deeply investigated. But the exact causal mechanism is, of course, unclear at this point. But I would, even though it's not clear, I think it's still important to stress that despite the fact that there are no firm answers on whether it's the chicken or the egg, to use your analogy there, we're able to take this very same relationship and test it in multiple data sets, and each time that we test it, it continues to emerge. And so the fact that we don't necessarily know exactly how it operates at this point shouldn't minimize the fact that its impact seems to be consistent across many different adolescent populations and different samples of kids. And if it was just this sort of accidental finding, what we would term a spurious relationship, something that just happened to work out in the data that wasn't necessarily replicable, that we couldn't find time and time and again, does not in fact seem to be the case. We seem to be able to do these similar analyses in different populations and be able to find consistent findings time and time again.
So it seems like the clear message that's coming through to me is that regardless of what all is involved, if we can keep our young people from engaging in the use of substances, whether it's alcohol, whether it's prescription drug abuse, whatever the issue may be, marijuana, we are doing them a service. We're also doing our communities a service, and we may be at least can't point to any individual, but at least statistically, we're going to be decreasing the burden of suicide in our communities if we can really address some of these substance use problems in a more effective way. Am I hearing a true conclusion here, or is it just something I'm jumping to?
No, I think you're absolutely right. If nothing else, you decrease the chances of a later bad outcome. And sometimes it's difficult to talk about, I think, because there are all these generalizations, and we will dichotomize things as good or bad. But it might be easier if we put some firm numbers on it. And one I'll give you here is we've done some of the analysis that we've done where we've looked at the likelihood that a person is going to attempt suicide if they start drinking earlier. And again, if you go back to the 13 and 15-year-olds, if you just look at whether they began drinking earlier, began drinking before the age of 13 years, and whether they reported a suicide attempt, and don't consider other things that might factor into it, but simply those two things. A person who begins drinking before the age of 13 years is six times more likely than somebody who does not drink alcohol to report a suicide attempt. Now,
that's
to me,
amazing.
That's a staggering number.
It is.
When you control, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I said that is because, I mean, you know, many times, I mean, people that aren't in the research community, I mean, they don't realize a lot of times when we're talking about increased risk, it's, you know, 50% or 60%. But, I mean, you know, here we're talking 500-600% increased risk. I mean, that is, that's incredible.
Yes. And I agree completely. And even when you control for things like symptoms of depression that we commonly associate with risk for suicide, that is a very strong indicator of risk for suicide. Even when you control symptoms of depression and some of the things that we know are also associated with suicide attempts like gender and conflict within the home, that still remains very high, the more than 2.5 times likely to report a suicide.
Wow. We're hearing some exciting insights from Dr. Robert Bossart. Dr. Bossart is actually researching extensively some of these associations with suicide, with substance use. We're learning things that can make a big difference in your community. You don't want to miss any of this program. We've got more to come. I'm Dr. DeRose. Don't go away.
American Indian Living will continue in a moment. If you have questions or comments about today's pre-recorded broadcast, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673.
America's veterans have served our country in both war and peace.
It's because of people like you that we are free.
My class was learning about war and how hard it is.
I wanted to do something to let them know how I feel.
Now there is a way to thank them for helping keep America free. Log on to thankyouveterans.org and type a personal message of thanks.
Dear Dad, I've recently come to understand how important your service to America was, and I just wanted to say thank you.
There are 26 million veterans living in America today, from World War II to Afghanistan and Iraq.
We carry our experiences inside. It's nice to have someone say thanks.
Let a veteran know you appreciate their service. Log on to thankyouveterans.org, a public service of Paralyzed Veterans of America.
This is the Duchess of York. What's really important in your life? It's your family and your friends. But isn't it also your health? People who are overweight or obese are at a greater risk for illnesses such as cancer. Check your BMI or body mass index. The lower the number, the lower the risk. So lose weight in a healthy way. You'll lower your BMI number. Now, isn't that important? Visit the website of the American Cancer Society at www.cancer.org. You and your family and friends will be glad you did.
Thank you for listening to American Indian Living. If you missed some of the discussion, CD copies of today's show are available. CDs of previous broadcasts are also available. Our email address is AmericanIndianLiving@lifetalk.net. CD requests and comments can also be communicated by phone at 1-800-775-4673. That's 1-800-775-4673. Stay with us for the second half of today's program.
You're listening to a pre-recorded broadcast of American Indian Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE, 1-800-775-4673. Here again is your host.
Welcome back to American Indian Living. Dr. David DeRose here. We're speaking about alcohol, other substance use, and violence, particularly suicide. We're talking with Dr. Robert Bossart. Dr. Bossart has his PhD. He is an epidemiologist, that is a scientist, who studies diseases and conditions that affect people groups, looks for associations, and is really, for those of you who are not very informed in the area of medical research, the epidemiologists are the ones who often get the initial insights into risk factors, things that increase our risk of disease, increase our risk for early death, and a lot of the things that we do in medical science and public health are based initially on research gathered by epidemiologists like Dr. Bossart. Robert, we've been speaking about this whole issue of substance use, and you know, as we've been talking, someone I know has come to mind a number of times. I remember a story he told me. He said that when he was growing up, he was just a young kid. His mother rolled a joint for he and his brother, just, you know, young kids, and said, "Here, kids, why don't you, you know, smoke marijuana here at home because you're going to be, you know, exposed to this outside. I'd rather have you doing it with your mom than with anybody else." I think in various shapes or fashions, many people somehow think that the real danger with substance use is when it's not supervised. And we make such a big issue about it. I mean, some people are even saying too big an issue in North America. And if it wasn't so much a focus, we just didn't make a big deal out of it, kids would do fine. They could be as young as they wanted and use these substances, whether it's marijuana or alcohol. You've been looking at the research. You're looking at the data. Is this a reasonable conclusion? Are we just too concerned about these issues?
No. And as a matter of fact, I'm sure that some of your listeners will be aware that there's been a movement in recent years, at least the past couple of years, by some university presidents and by some community organizations to make exactly that argument, that we've really put too much emphasis on early drinking and that we should think about reducing the drinking age again and we should normalize alcohol use by taking away all the criminal activities and the stigma that we've put upon it, and that it's all of the negative perceptions about early alcohol use that are contributing to a lot of problem drinking behaviors, and if we would simply take those away, that people could use alcohol more responsibly at younger ages and not have all the bad outcomes that you and I have been talking about. And I would disagree with that for a couple of reasons. And the first is, you know, scientifically, some of the literature that we talked about before that's looked at even prenatal alcohol use and long-term psychiatric diagnoses later on that are very well established. And the growing body of literature that we've been talking about, the population-level research that we've been talking about that shows that early alcohol use among early adolescents and older children is associated with bad outcomes later on, be they fighting or criminal activity or risk for suicide. But I think the evidence is further strengthened by the fact that this does not seem to be a unique phenomena for us, that this is not just an American problem, and that some of the research that we're in the very early stages of looking at, where we're doing comparative research with data from the United States and data from other countries, suggests that this very same relationship, the one that I've told you about between early alcohol use and risk for suicide, seems to hold, and that the data that we've been looking at early on includes information from countries where they've taken exactly that approach, where people begin drinking much earlier, where alcohol use within the home is something that's considered acceptable, even among earlier adolescents and younger adults. So if that, in fact, were the case, if there was no, in fact, concrete relationship between these two things, you would not expect those relationships to be consistent between what we see here in the United States and what we were able to see in other areas. And the fact that that is the case argues against both the idea that we can somehow take away the social stigma from this and that these negative relationships will go away, as well as the re-emphasizes the importance of maintaining existing legal restrictions and enforcing those that are in place that we may tend to sort of look away from thinking it's all sort of harmless fun.
I mean, this is very sobering information, no pun intended. Robert, tell me this as we speak about this issue. I know you don't have all the data, you're actively looking into this, but what is your kind of hunch, because you're someone who's deeply into the science behind this. Do you think that in a child 10, 11, 12, maybe even 14, 15, maybe 16 even, is the brain so sensitive in these still developing that alcohol, perhaps other substances, may have caused lasting changes to the brain that predispose people to these bad outcomes later on? I mean, is that possible, or do you think the data is not pointing in that direction?
Well, I'm going to walk a very fine line here. I'm going to leave the real definitive answers to the biomedical researchers and stick to what I know best. But I can tell you that the preliminary evidence seems to suggest that there is certainly some sort of impact of either neurobiologically or biochemically or biologically, that there is certainly some impact. Now, exactly what age it is that the cognitive development or the impact on cognitive development begins and ends, and that I'm not as certain about. There is most certainly an impact on again, if you go back to the prenatal research of children exposed to alcohol before they're born, either by mothers who drink, there's a better established record of both social and cognitive deficits that are associated with prenatal alcohol use. It, of course, becomes more difficult because it's easy for people to understand, myself included, how a baby who's developing in the womb is impacted more strongly by something than a person who seems to be, you know, beyond that really critical period of development. But I think it's important to remember that people are still developing cognitively and socially through their adolescent years. So the fact that there would be an impact on children if they begin drinking, or early adolescents, if they begin drinking before the age of 13 years, should not surprise us. I think that we all understand that people are still developing, and whether the impact is social or the impact is biochemical, the point is there is an impact, and that this is a modifiable impact. And if we have firm evidence that the use of alcohol before the age of 13 years, or the use of any substance, and we can even take it away from alcohol, if we have evidence that an exposure to something is associated with a bad outcome, it just seems to make sense that we try to restrict access to whatever it is that is associated with that bad outcome. And the evidence is consistent, and it's continued to be reproduced in other data sources or from other populations that shows that these relationships are strong. And if we have such strong evidence, I think we need to pay attention to it. That certainly opens the door for continued investigations on why exactly it would happen. But to me, at least as a population-level researcher, at this point, that's less important than understanding that it does happen and that we should probably take steps to prevent that outcome now while we get better answers later.
No, I mean, I think it's a powerful message, and I think for anyone who's been listening to the show, Robert, it's coming through loud and clear that one of the things we can do to make a significant impact on a host of problems in our communities, whether it's suicide, whether it's criminal behavior, whether it's fighting, whether it's high-risk sexual behaviors, is to help our kids not use these substances, especially not use them at an early age. Practical strategies. I mean, people might be nodding their heads. They might be saying, well, I mean, this is all really interesting, but I wouldn't make the mistake that that parent made and, you know, be giving my kids drugs when they're in grade school. What things can a community member do? What can a parent or grandparent do that can really make a practical difference? Is that something that you've actually looked at?
Well, it's something we certainly always discuss. I mean, I think it's important, particularly in public health and particularly in the line of research and work that I do, to not just give people numbers, but to provide them with some suggestions on what they can do. I think the first and most important thing that they can do is to create an environment where it's not condoned, and you can do that in a number of ways. So you mentioned, of course, the home, and doing by creating that environment by speaking with your children or speaking with the youth in the community. But you can also do it by supporting and letting your legislators and community leaders know that you support legislation that restricts access, that you enforce existing laws. We have existing laws that say that alcohol shouldn't be sold or provided to people under the age of 21 years. And it's simply letting people know that you respect those and enforce them and you support them. And the other is to let your voice be heard and make sure that you speak out if there are movements to provide access. To some degree, and in New York State, there was recently an article where I live where they're thinking about charging parents who provide alcohol to parents provide alcohol to children in their homes. And it gets back to that mindset you were talking about that still is prevalent among many parents, where as long as it's in my home, it's going to be okay. So understanding the homes that your children go to and that the communities go to, understanding the climate that exists within your community, letting your legislators know that you support underage drinking restrictions, and that I think those are the key. I mean, there are others, of course, that come into place. Tougher penalties for establishments that serve alcohol or provide alcohol to minors, or higher taxes, and those have all been shown to reduce rates of alcohol use among adolescents. But I think any time you mention taxes, particularly in this climate, you're getting into treacherous waters, so I'll avoid that.
Okay. Well, you know, the other interesting question that comes up, you know, when we're speaking about a behavior that may be in a certain sense acceptable in a certain age range, there's often this question. When we speak about the home environment, we speak maybe about tribal gatherings, whatever it might be, the way adults behave, does that make a difference? I mean, if a parent is using alcohol in the home, is this a bad indicator for whether the children are going to use alcohol or not? I mean, has that been looked at? Do we have to be careful even as adults in what settings if we choose to engage in some of these behaviors, where we do it? Has that been looked at?
Absolutely. And the home environment is one of the key characteristics to preventing substance use and alcohol use. And the question about do parent behaviors, are they then modeled by the adolescents? The very clear answer is yes. One of the key factors that we've found in reducing alcohol early, because we've looked exactly at what household and community characteristics are associated with higher rates of early alcohol use, and some of them would be just the ones you expect: good communication between parents and the children, parental monitoring, and something as simple as parents saying to their children, where are you going to be, what time are you going to be home, who are you going to be with, you know, not necessarily creating an environment where people feel like they're suffocated, but simply involvement. And it's those sorts of things that are typically associated with better outcomes for kids, more self-efficacy and self-esteem, greater community engagement with schools. One of the things we identified, my colleague Monica Nswan and I, again, who I work with frequently, when we looked at early alcohol use and racial and ethnic differences in early alcohol use, we found that for some minority groups, the community exposure was particularly relevant. Exposure to violence within the community or exposure to violence within the home became a high risk factor for early alcohol use among those groups. So I think that while we focus on the home quite extensively, we should also try to understand that this is, you know, bigger than the community.
Yeah, it's these are important issues, and hopefully you're making some very important connections with things you can do at a community level or in your home that can make a difference as far as your children, your grandchildren, and the future generations in general. I'm Dr. David DeRose. We've got a final segment of today's edition of American Indian Living. Dr. Bossart will be with us giving us some final insights that you don't want to miss on suicide prevention. Stay tuned.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
Today's American Indian Living radio program is sponsored in part by the Lifestyle Center of America. Located in South Central Oklahoma, the Lifestyle Center provides a variety of health services in Indian country, including residential diabetes treatment programs and their Wellspring DVD series, a prepackaged diabetes program suitable for home, workplace, or community center and used by people of all races. Further information about the center is available at lifestylecenter.org or by phone at 800-596-5480. American Indian Living is also sponsored in part by the Native Education and Health Initiative, known as NAHAI, a nonprofit organization established by Native Americans for Native Americans. In addition to sponsoring American Indian Living, NAHAI produces a health publication and has initiated a series of programs to combat diabetes. Further information about NAHAI is available at nahaicharity.org.
Canned vegetables. Hey, Duncan, get over here. Need you to stay with me and your brother, okay?
I am.
Well, closer. Come on, help me out here, buddy. Excuse me. Duncan, you're blocking me out.
I want some bologna.
Not today.
But I want them.
Sorry. Duncan!
I want to put the number thing.
Too bad.
Mommy would let me.
Okay, well, she's not here, okay? She's gone, and she's not coming back, and you're just going to have to deal with it like the rest of us, okay? Duncan.
On May 29th, Michelle Jimenez was killed by a drunk driver. She left behind her husband and four children. Drinking and driving is a crime that kills abruptly, but the pain lasts forever. Friends don't let friends drive drunk. A message from the U.S. Department of Transportation, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to a pre-recorded broadcast of American Indian Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE, 1-800-775-4673. Here again is your host.
Welcome back to American Indian Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. We're speaking today with Dr. Robert Bossart. Dr. Bossart is an assistant professor with the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester in New York. He is also the chief for epidemiology and health services research with the Center of Excellence for Canandaigua, dealing especially with suicide prevention in United States veterans. Dr. Bossart, we've been speaking a lot about the impact of suicide, things that we can do in, at the home level and at the community to make a difference. And before we speak about some more of these points to really help our listeners get the most mileage out of this show, let's again give some of those real essential numbers. Really, you've got an important toll-free number that if someone right now is dealing with thoughts of worthlessness, don't feel like their life has any meaning, maybe even thinking of taking their life, what is the National Suicide Prevention Hotline?
Sure. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline number is 1-800-273-TALK. And that can be accessed toll-free throughout the country.
So it's a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week type line? I mean, it's always staffed by somebody?
Correct. You will always be able to speak to somebody, and that person can help identify resources or contacts within the local community, or in the case of the Veterans Administration, at the very least, or be able to provide them with immediate access to services if they're needed.
Okay, so again, that number, 1-800-273, and then the word TALK, 1-800-273-TALK for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. Robert, there are many people listening right now who they're not thinking about suicide. They realize, though, this is a huge problem in communities. It's not just a Native American issue. It's an issue that affects people across every ethnic and racial line. And they're saying, you know, I've heard a lot of good ideas on this show, but I'd really like more information. I've heard some of the information about connections with alcohol, substance abuse. I know there's all kinds of material out there on the Internet. There's all kinds of agencies, research groups like your own that are involved with this. But are there a few places maybe that would be good starting points if someone says, look, I want to do more, either on a personal level or a community level?
Absolutely. The one that I would start with, or the two that I would start with that are specific to suicide, would be the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention can be found easily on the Internet. It's at afsp.org. And they provide a lot of information about suicide prevention activities in general. They are a nonprofit organization. They provide, through foundation grants, an extensive amount of funding for research throughout this country, and they do a wonderful job at it. They funded some of my own work. They provide educational resources. They're also the ones who sponsor the annual Out of Darkness Walks, which is primarily how they fund their suicide prevention research. So anybody who's interested could go there and learn a lot about suicide prevention, both in general and maybe get some ideas that would be specific or some contacts that are specific to their community. And the other place would be the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, SPRC.org, and they as well provide a lot of information on state-specific activities as well as community community members that might be around that would also help them perhaps come up with ideas or be able to provide information on a more local level.
Now, some of our listeners, Robert, are feeling like they do when someone leaves a message on their voicemail. You know, we all know our own telephone numbers. We could just rattle them off real quickly. So let's make sure we've got these websites down.
Sure.
The first one you mentioned, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, is just the initials, AFSP.org. Have I got that right?
That's
okay,
correct.
So American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP.org, one excellent resource or material. Then the other one you mentioned was the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, is that right?
That is correct.
Now, but that's
that
just
is,
three initials.
Well, it's four.
Okay.
SPRC, yes, SPRC.org.
Okay. Okay, so Suicide Prevention Resource Center, SPRC.org. So AFSP, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and Suicide Prevention Resource Center, SPRC.org. If we've still gone through those two quickly for you, if you call the station that is airing this show, we typically send all of our affiliates information, contact information for further resources. These websites will be on that information that we send to the stations, so you can get that again through whatever fine station is airing this program. Go ahead, Robert.
I was just going to point out one thing I think might be of interest to your listeners is if they are interested in this, they can go to the SPRC, the Suicide Prevention Resource Center website, and they can sign up for a weekly email that will provide them with information and activities. And they have, if you scroll down to the bottom of the page, they have a news and highlights section where you can get both national, state, and tribal information and information on international rates and activities and research as well. So they do a really nice job of trying to make it useful for the community members and people within the communities who are really interested in maybe finding out more or doing something about suicide within their community.
Now, that is tremendous. So let's come back then to some of the key messages that we want to walk away from this program with. You've been telling us a lot about some of these very compelling statistics about early substance use, and maybe you could recap that if some have just joined us.
Sure. Well, we're specific to what we've been speaking about today is specific to the age of first alcohol use before 13 years, and the fact that it's when you compare kids who begin drinking before the age of 13 to kids who don't drink at all, it seems to consistently be raise risk for suicide attempts by about 2%, 2 to 2.5 times the risk. Even when you take out of the equation things like depression, diagnoses of depression and treatment, relationships with the family, self-efficacy, so how strongly a kid feels about how they can handle problems within their life, even when you factor in all the things that we typically think will explain away risk for suicide, early substance use still seems to remain a significant risk factor for suicide attempts.
So basically what we can do as parents, grandparents, community members, tribal members, is really kind of raise the bar as far as our expectations of really having zero tolerance for young kids in our communities using alcohol or other substances. Is that a fair way to summarize some of the important take-home messages?
I think absolutely. So, in fact, I think the take-home message is really to built upon what we've discussed over the past hour or so in its entirety, and is to stay aware, make sure you create an environment where people feel comfortable reaching out for help, stay informed either through SPRC or AFSP or other sources of information within the community, people who know about this, so that you create an environment where those at risk, be they adolescents or older adults, I think that it's safe to say that these strategies apply to everyone, are in an environment where they don't feel like they're going to be somehow looked down upon or marginalized if they do express a need for help, that we create an environment where we're aware of the risk factors, we've taken steps to prevent them, but that we also create an environment where people feel comfortable reaching out for help when they need it.
Very good point. There's people that are listening today, I know, Robert, especially maybe younger people at transition points, maybe in their career. They're saying, you know, I'd really like to make a difference like Robert is, just on a tribal level, maybe on a level of, Indian country in general. And they're saying, well, how would someone ever get into a field like Dr. Bossard is involved with? Do you have just a kind of a quick insight, maybe a little bio on how you got into doing this work and how someone else may follow in your footsteps if they're interested?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that it's relatively easy to become important and meaningful to, in particular, suicide prevention. So much of the suicide prevention activities done within this country are done at the grassroots level by community advocates and volunteers. And if somebody's interested in doing that, I would urge them to find the community organizations that are near them and begin to be involved. My particular work, I completed my PhD in sociology, actually. At the University of Notre Dame, where I was interested in medical research and health outcomes and patterns of population level, patterns of behavior as they relate to health. And then I went to the Centers for Disease Control, which has a postdoctoral training program in epidemiology called Epidemic Intelligence Service. And people can find information about that on the web as well.
Okay, very good. So there are opportunities for you to make a difference, not only by things that you do in your own home, do in your own community, but you can become involved, whether it's through a community agency, a grassroots level involvement, or whether you go on to get further training, as Dr. Bossard has done. Robert Bossard, assistant professor with the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester. Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
I hope each one of you who is tuned in to today's edition of American Indian Living has taken away some practical things that can make a difference in your community. Really, setting an environment where people can communicate, where they can speak about these issues, and realizing the connection between early substance use and suicide, as well as other bad outcomes, very significant messages.
Thank you for listening to American Indian Living. We hope today's program has contributed to your living a healthy life. American Indian Living Radio is brought to you by the Native Education and Health Initiative in partnership with the Lifestyle Center of America and Life Talk Radio. American Indian Living is also distributed through the public radio satellite system by American Indian Radio on Satellite, a service of Native American Public Telecommunications.